Welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to see your faces and to share our practice during Passover. And I hope that we're able this year to observe Passover in a way that deepens our ongoing practice of liberation. And as I said in the introduction to our sit, that our practice is an ongoing exercise in liberation from the narrow places in our minds, liberation from our rigid ways of thinking into spacious awareness. We seek freedom from that narrow place in which our fixed ideas limit our ability to see ourselves and each other just as we are in each moment, constantly evolving and changing. Our inner Pharaoh, the true tyrant, is in our meditation practice the fixed idea of me as a separate, solid self cut off from the web of relationships that sustain us and that constantly evolve together through our interactions. In Jewish terms, we could say that each of us, while appearing for a brief lifetime as an individual, is actually part of the oneness of creation. In being born, we move out of being one with everything, and in dying, we return to that state. Chemically, our molecules become recycled, and spiritually, perhaps, we imagine that our souls are no longer constrained by our bodies. Last week, Reb Moshe reminded us of the role of Elijah, who comes in non-human form or else in disguise to visit us on Passover and to make sure the generations are staying connected, talking to each other. After he mentioned the book Becoming Elijah, I listened to the beginning chapters of the book on our drive to and from Seder in New York and learned that Elijah has been experienced through the ages as the divine presence who appears on earth in human form and then returns to where? To the divine abode, only to reappear later in some other disguise. There's a back and forth movement, emerging from oneness with all of life to become a person, a prophet, a messenger, and then disappearing again into oneness with the divine. This theme, the movement of emergence and return, is echoed in several of our Passover readings. And so I looked up what is on the list of things for our Shabbat service tomorrow. And if I am correct, we will read the passages from Exodus that describe Moses' longing to get to know Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in a more satisfying way. Now we know from previous readings that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh has been both extremely close and present for Moses, but also unknowable. So just to review, we recall that Moses asks at the burning bush, "When I come to the Israelites and they ask me, 'What is his name, this one who sent you here?' what shall I say to them?" And God responds, "Ehyeh asher ehyeh." A mysterious response, often understood as, "I will be what I will be." It is not a name, but a description of reality coming into being at each moment. Never being still or fixed, never able to be captured. And yet, this does not stop Moses or us from wanting to capture some image of God, wanting something we can hold on to. So in our reading tomorrow, we jump ahead to Exodus chapter 33, right after the story of the golden calf and the smashing of the tablets. And here we find conflicting and even more confusing descriptions of Moses' relationship with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. On the one hand, we learn in verse 11 that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh would speak to Moses face to face as one person speaks to another. And in the very next verse that we read tomorrow, Moses begs, "Now, if I have truly gained your favor, pray let me know your ways that I may know you and continue in your favor." How do we understand this? That Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh speaks to Moses face to face, but Moses still feels that he does not know Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? What is it that Moses feels he is lacking? Is Moses looking for a relationship that feels like a relationship with another person? Is Moses not satisfied with all the experiences of hearing, responding to, and being empowered, even embodying Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? Does Moses want, like so many of us, something more tangible and earthy, some proof, some hard data that we are loved and cared for by God? So God answers Moses, "I will make my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim before you the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and the grace that I grant, and the compassion that I show. But you cannot see my face, for a human being may not see me and live." So Moses receives special instructions to climb to a specific place on Mount Sinai, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh instructs, "As my presence passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock and shield you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." So Moses reascends Mount Sinai, this time bringing tablets that he carved from stone, a joint project in which he does not simply receive tablets from God, but co-creates them with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who promises to inscribe upon them the words that were on the first tablets, which you shattered. I think it's interesting that in this verse, God reminds Moses that he shattered the tablets. When Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh passes before Moses, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh proclaims the name of God, this time, not Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, but the 13 attributes that we chant on Yom Kippur, of course. Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'Chanun, the compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness, is the name of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Rabbi Jeff Roth has offered us a beautiful interpretation of this encounter in which Moses faces God's back as God passes before him. Rabbi Jeff Roth understands this as the opportunity for Moses to see the world as God sees the world, as if through God's eyes, from God's perspective, as God passes before him and he's looking at the world just as God does, because God's facing out and Moses can see only the back of God. And God's perspective is, as described in the 13 attributes, one of infinite compassion. This interpretation suggests that Moses' close and special relationship with God, and perhaps our relationship as well, offers a perspective of infinite compassion if we can look out at the world through God's perspective. And this is wondrous, but it seems we're always longing for more evidence or a more tangible connection with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now, the Haftorah reading tomorrow is Ezekiel's vision in the Valley of the Dry Bones. And Ezekiel describes how the bones not only reconnect, but are enlivened by the Spirit of God entering into them. This poem is often interpreted as a metaphor for a resurrection of the Jewish people. Ezekiel has to summon the Spirit from the four directions of the world to enliven and create a being from the bones. So once again, this poem refers to a mysterious process by which a living person or a living nation emerges from the oneness of spirit. And then, if this were not enough on the schedule for tomorrow, the Megillah reading for the holiday is the Song of Songs. This very sensual love poem is understood as a metaphor for the passionate relationship between God and the Jewish people. And again, this is rather confusing. As Jews, we are constantly reminded that God is not a being, not knowable, not personifiable. You can't even pronounce God's name. And yet in this poem, we celebrate our relationship with God in very earthy, sensual terms. All five senses of taste, smell, touch, sight, and sound are stimulated by the imagery of the poem. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh emerges from nothingness to appear as a passionate lover. So these images, Elijah's appearance at the Seder, our reading in Exodus of Moses begging for a closer connection to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Ezekiel's vision, and the Song of Songs all provide a wonderful context for reading a poem that I'd like to share with you today and discuss, called Hill Country by Tracy K. Smith, who is Poet Laureate from 2017 to 2019, who lives in Newton. And earlier this month, TBZ was treated to a reading, her reading this poem in person at TBC, along with the screening of a wonderful episode in the Poetry in America series that was created and hosted by TBC member Alyssa New. Now, this episode was filmed in Texas Hill Country and takes us through the scenery of the poem. It includes interviews of people from Hill Country and from the clergy, including our Rav Claudia and Rav Teferet. And this episode, this like 25-minute video, really brings the poem alive with all its imagery. You know, you can see the country, you hear the music, and there are repeated readings of the poem. So I can't hope to give you that experience today by reading the poem. It will be on PBS on April 29th, after which it can be, after at some point you can live stream it and see it if you miss the event. So I'll read the poem once through, and I won't have you read it so that you can be surprised by the literal and figurative twists and turns. And then we'll read it together, looking at it. Maybe we'll pause for discussion as well. Hill Country. He comes down from the hills, from the craggy rock, the shrubs, the scrawny live oaks and dried up junipers, down from the cloud bellies and the bellies of hawks, from the caracaras stalking carcasses, from the clear, sun-smacked soundlessness that shrouds him, from the weathered bed of planks outside the cabin where he goes to be alone with his questions. God comes down along the road with his windows unrolled, so the twigs and hanging vines can slap and scrape against him in his jeep. Down past the buck caught in the hog trap that kicks and heaves, bloodied, blinded by the whiff of its own death, which God, thank God, staves off. He downshifts, crosses the shallow trickle of river that only just last May scoured the side of the canyon to rock. Gets out, walks along the limestone bank, castor beans, cactus, scat of last night's coyotes. Down below the hilltops, he squints out at a shadow, tree backing tree. Dark depth, the eyes glide across, not bothering to decipher what it hides. A pair of dragonflies mate in flight. Tiny flowers throw frantic color at his feet. If he tries, if he holds his mind in place and wills it, he can almost believe in something larger than himself, rearranging the air. He squints at the jeep, glaring in bright sun, stares a while at patterns the tree branches cast onto the undersides of leaves. Then God climbs back into the cab, returning to everywhere. So now I will read it again as I share the screen with you. So give me a moment to do that, and then we'll discuss it. Okay, are you able to see this now? Are people able to see? Okay, and I'll read it again and then we'll discuss it. Hill country. You don't have to look at it if it's enough to just hear it, but if you want to, it's here. He comes down from the hills, the craggy rock, the shrubs, the scrawny live oaks and dried up junipers, down from the cloud bellies and the bellies of hawks, from the caracaras stalking carcasses, from the clear sun-smacked soundlessness that shrouds him, from the weathered bed of planks outside the cabin, where he goes to be alone with his questions. God comes down along the road with his windows unrolled so the twigs and hanging vines can slap and scrape against him in his jeep. Down past the buck caught in the hog trap that kicks and heaves, bloodied, blinded by the whiff of its own death, which God, thank God, staves off. He downshifts, crosses the shallow trickle of river that only just last May scoured the side of the canyon to rock. Gets out, walks along the limestone bank, castor beans, cactus, scat of last night's coyotes. Down below the hilltops, he squints out at shadow, tree backing tree, dark depth. The eyes glide across, not bothering to decipher what it hides. A pair of dragonflies mate in flight. Tiny flowers throw frantic color at his feet. If he tries, if he holds his mind in place and wills it, he can almost believe in something larger than himself, rearranging the air. He squints at the jeep glaring in bright sun, stares a while at patterns the tall branches cast onto the undersides of leaves. Then God climbs back into the cab, returning to everywhere. So I will stop the recording so we can have a discussion.